Welcome to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. I'm Mike Quackenbush, and that's Clayton Morris. And we might dispense with the usual hoo-ha this week on the program, because this one is unlike all others.
Yeah, this episode is going to be the last episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. And, you know, it's been a good run. And we thought, hey, it's the end of the year. It's roughly about 10 years now we've been doing this show. And you know, with the turning of the new year, with the things that Mike and I are focused on in the new year, did the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe fit into that schedule, into the things that we're looking forward to in the new year? And we had to say no. So, yes, this is going to be the final episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. And it's kind of hard to believe. It's kind of hard to believe that it's been like 10 years of doing the show. Can you believe it?
Right. It has been a constant for us, even though it's moved, you know, it used to come out on Mondays. Then it came out for a while. It was on Thursdays. It's moved around in the 10 years. It's going to be strange not to have it. And I know Clayton did a lot of soul searching about the future of the Grizz. For me, less so, because for me, it's always just been about that huge paycheck. And with Bake Me right. a Wish deciding that, you know, the holidays are going to mark the end of their sponsorship time and Yoohoo no longer returning our phone calls, it mm-hmm. seemed like, right, we're going to have to go somewhere else for that big, fat royalty podcasting check, which I know all you fellow podcasters know about.
Oh, yeah, it's just huge. I mean, we don't have to even work at all. I mean, the only reason, right, we don't even have to go to a 9-to-5 job.
Only to combat Grizz. Boredom.
Right.
That's the only reason.
I mean, we literally, let's just be honest with people, right? I mean, with the Grizz has been such a moneymaker and profit center for us mm-hmm. that you and I bought that yacht together. Yeah.
That's right.
And we decided that we're, you know, now that we've got the yacht, thanks to the payments from the Grizz, we're just going to go out and spend the rest of our days at sea.
It was just a matter of time before the U.S. Treasury felt threatened by us minting our own money. Of course, that mint was the Grizz. It was a license to print cash. And, you know, I don't want to pull back the curtain too much, but the storage and bandwidth when you're storing 440 episodes of a podcast that always runs an hour – Anyway, the Grizz has been a constant for you and I for quite some time, and we got in right when podcasting was a new form. If you were so unfortunate as to go back and listen to like the first 20 or 40 Grizzes, you do get a sense of what a nascent platform podcasting was. We didn't really know what we were doing, but nor did anybody else. We were one of the very first in the sphere. It's been a remarkable ride, and the program has changed shape a lot. There were years where we were more interview heavy, and I want to spend some time talking about that in just a little bit. And we went through our phases too, where we were kind of themed, right? We did our summer of Trek. We did our summer of duds. We did our summer of 80s cartoon pilots. We did all the They Might Be Giants albums. We went hard into themes, and as it changed shape over the years, no matter what it turned into, like, this hour that you and I get together every week kind of remained constant, no matter what the content was.
Right. And it started to kind of go back to the beginning of it. It started because no matter where you and I lived across the country, we would always just jump on the phone and talk as friends, you know, just catch up and, hey, here's what I'm watching these days. Did you see that movie? You know, the Spider-Man this, Spider-Man that. What are you doing in your life right now? How's work? How's the business? All of those things. And we just decided at one point, hey, there's probably some other like-minded, you know, geeks out there that would enjoy some of this talk. Let's start recording it. And it was exciting. It was fun at the beginning. You're right to think about the beginnings of this and how nascent it was. I mean, our friend Jim Harold over at the Paranormal Podcast, he was really early to the game as well. And you know, that was kind of amazing. He's been around now for just a little bit longer than we've been around. I remember at the time the Ricky Gervais podcast was out, and that was really popular. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of fun. There were a couple of other early podcasts before us. Of course, we weren't like the first or by any means, but it was. I think at the time we were using, even our website was being published using iWeb, which was a Mac application that came pre-installed on the Mac about 10 years ago. using iWeb, and we would put our podcast up there, and it was a royal pain to publish. I mean, back then it was, you know, podcasting really only came about because of RSS, RSS feeds. And thanks to that, we were able to have sort of weekly published RSS schedules for podcasts. But yeah, the early days of this show, we didn't, it's funny how we really didn't know what we were doing. But no, like you said, no one did. You just kind of like, all right, let's see who wants to listen to this. We didn't even have a way of tracking it. There wasn't even like really good. I remember I had lunch with a guy from PodTrack at one point. I had lunch with a guy in New York because they were bursting on the scene as a way of measuring how many people were actually listening. And at the time, we had no idea. I mean, no one did. It actually comes at an interesting time right now because Apple is about to release or just released their new podcast analytics feature for publishers. And this was something that they had hinted about over the summer during WWDC. And now it's giving podcast producers an enormous amount of data. You know, like, hey, when how far do people listen into an episode? At what point do they tune out? Do they skip forward on a commercial? Do they do this? Do they do that? So now publishers are going to have access to all kinds of data that we could have only imagined having when we first started this.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about how many years this Yeti Blue microphone has been in front of me, and all the great things that came our way. Because of the Grizz, but also during the Grizz. And I'll tell you a story right now, which I think I've never told to you before. So I continue to use the Yeti Blue, but I don't know if you remember, several years ago, you had equipped me with a different microphone. Do you remember what that microphone was?
Yeah, the Rode Podcaster microphone.
That's it. Yeah, the Rode Podcaster. Now, I don't have the Rode Podcaster anymore, but I do know where it went. And I won't mention anybody's name here, but a very devout fan was going through some extreme emotional distress and I believe made a fairly serious effort to take her own life several years ago. When that was over, as a method of coping with everything that she was going through, but also to express what she went through, perhaps as a means of reaching other people who felt the same, she decided to start a podcast of her own. Hmm. But she didn't know where to begin. And she reached out to me and said, I've always been a fan of your podcast. How could I start on this and maybe turn some of my pain into relief for other people? And I was so moved by that that I gave her the Rode microphone that you had given me to get her podcast up and running. So I've always been loyal to the Yeti Blue because my Rode podcaster, I think, went to a very worthy cause many years ago.
Yeah, some of the equipment has changed over the years, and we had some really terrible microphones in the beginning. And then once we stepped it up, and you know, I remember at one point I said, okay, we've got to really start stepping up our audio quality. One of the things that was happening in the podcast space was people are not going to listen to your podcast if the audio is bad, if there's poor quality audio. We've got to really step it up. We've got to soundproof our rooms to the best of our ability, not have like a hollow bingo hall sound to it. Can we have some carpeting in here? I even put up sound panels at one point.
It's the only reason I carpeted my cave.
You know, it's funny that people are pretty forgiving of audio quality if like the actual, you know, like background is okay if you hear some stuff happening and whatever. But, you know, if you're mobile, hey, this person is at this event right now and has ducked into a conference room, but he's got a good microphone. You can hear some of the commotion in the background. That's fine. As long as the audio quality of the subject is good, people are really forgiving in the podcast space. And that's, you know, solidified itself over the years. But people are not forgiving of it sounding like you're, you know, 20 feet away from a microphone. People will just like turn you off. So yeah, I've got the Yeti Blue. We're up here in the mountains for the holiday still. So I've got the Yeti Blue up here and I've done a lot of podcasts up here as well. So yeah, it's with some sadness that we've arrived at the end of this journey, but I'm excited for what's next for us. So I thought it'd be fun to kind of, you know, just talk a little bit about what, you know, some of our fondest memories of the show, and people can feel free to share their thoughts and favorite things on our Grizzly Bear Facebook page if they like. But yeah, do you want to do a little walk down memory lane, as it were?
Sure. You know, one of the main topics here on the Grizz has always been music, and a lot's gone down in the last 10 years. When we started the Grizz, for example, I was an avid Chris Isaak fan. And my fandom lapsed during the period that the Grizz was on the air. We've seen bands like the Cranberries and Simply Red break up and get back together all during the span of the Grizz. But if I was going to talk just about music for a second, I think this is maybe the most significant thing that came our way as a result of the Grizz, and I'd like to hear how you feel about it. Back in December of 2013, hard to believe it was over 4 years ago, we stumbled across a Scottish band called The Blue Nile. As part of an exploration of a retrofitted genre description, Sophistopop. The Blue Nile have grown into one of my favorite musical acts. I listen to them as much as I listen to anything anymore, in particular their album Hats. And that was only discovered because of something that we were doing for The Grizz. I don't know that The Blue Nile would be part of my life without The Grizz. What about you?
Yeah, for sure. When we were doing that sort of look at Sophistopop and diving into that genre, which I never even really – I never knew was an actual genre. Who else is in that mix? Style Council?
Style Council, Simply Red, Chardet, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And so for sure, there's been a lot of things that I've discovered just, you know, going back and forth with you over the many years – Blue Nile being one of them, Style Council being another. There's been a lot that's been uncovered. I would say musically, you know, on the show, some of the stuff that stuck with me that stood out to me the most is having our friends from They Might Be Giants on the show. And we can talk more about that in the interviews that we've had a little bit later. But that still stands out to me as one of the real high points of being able to do this show. This show sort of forced me out of my comfort zone sometimes to explore some of the different music, different things that you were into that I might not necessarily check out on my own, but you sort of, you know, forced me into, and I think vice versa, might have forced you into some things, and some of it stayed, some of it went, but hey, that's how you discover some new stuff. And I know that our audience as well, we've heard from them over the years that's been a theme as well, that they've, thanks to us mentioning it here on the show. They've dove into it. Chris Isaak, by the way, my wife had purchased tickets for her dad for his birthday, or maybe it was for Christmas. Actually, it might have been, yeah, no, his birthday, and for the holidays. Yeah, he was doing a holiday show out in the Bay Area where he's from. Mm-hmm. And then she just got like a notification on her credit card or whatever or email that hey, the concert's canceled. And apparently that's happened like 2 years in a row. Like he got pneumonia and then that's it. No holiday concert. So like every year he's trying to do a holiday concert and he cancels because of like pneumonia.
Yeah. He's been plagued by health problems in recent years. The same is true of Dolores from the Cranberries. You know, their whole North American tour was canceled because of her health.
Huh. Yeah, I'd like to see him in concert. Do you remember the Chris Isaak show, by the way?
Yeah, that was very funny. And someone I knew who was like, might as well have been the president of the Chris Isaak fan club said, yeah, like when you meet him in person, that is his sense of humor. Like he has that super wry sense of humor.
Yeah, I would love to see him in concert. And I wonder what he plays now, because a lot of his solo stuff in recent years, I haven't bought any of it because
no,
I just went, you know, I don't even know when the last album I bought of his. I bought a bunch through like one of those music clubs at one point, you know.
Right.
I stocked up on a lot of his stuff because when Baja Sessions came out, I was like, I love this album. And I went back and then I got, was it San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Days?
Album?
Is it San Francisco?
San Francisco Days, yeah. And a couple of his other ones. And then it really just fell off for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Whiskers Morris used to get big boxes from Columbia House there on Independence Drive filled with Chris Isaak and Harry Connick albums.
Did you? So, yeah, I'm not sure how many of our audience remember like ordering all those like Columbia House CDs that you would get and you would sign up. You know, they would send you the card in the mail and you could get 10 discs for the price of one or something like that.
I think that was the BMG offer. And I think with Columbia House, it was like 9 for a penny, but then you buy 6 at full price.
Okay. But the full price was not full price that we're used to. They were like $19.99 or something, right?
Right. And then the shipping was like another $19.99. Like you'd buy a CD and you'd get an invoice for $40 and be like, how did this happen?
Right. But so in order to, and then you could like, you know, regularly purchase CDs through them over the years then based on your club membership. But because you and I wanted to continue to get those penny you know, those penny CDs, we would sign up fake members of our family on a regular basis. So I certainly signed up myself, my parents. I signed up like fake brothers and sisters. And then at one point, yes, I did sign up my cat, Whiskers Morris, for the BMG club.
You clever fraudster. No, Whiskers Morris didn't live at my house. He lived cat a corner. There was no way I could sign Whiskers up. But you knew that the gurus at Columbia House would have been on to that.
Right. And you can tell they were really concerned about it. I mean, those CDs would show up like 5 days later.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious to know if we ever talked about this on The Grizz, because we made about 430 of these. Do you know how that worked? Like how Columbia House functioned?
I mean, if you're asking me, you know, if you run a business, right, your cost of doing business must be exceeded by the sale of your goods or services. So
I see. So yeah, you understood.
is there some other method? I mean, they're selling you ridiculously overpriced CDs, luring you in with a penny CD. It probably costs them, you know, $5 to get the CD, and they're charging you $20 when you buy the full price ones, right?
So each of them was tied to a major record label, even if later they got consolidated. So let's say, for example, that Columbia Records, CBS, let's say that they overproduced how many the Grateful Dead's greatest hits that they needed. They had them in such gross volumes that just to get rid of them, they could make these kinds of offers. But that's also why you saw certain record labels weren't represented, right? Like certain record label artists never appeared in the Columbia House catalog. They just used it as a way to clear out their warehouse. It was all the overrun stuff where it went out to retailers and then later came back. You know, we couldn't sell 800 million Hootie and the Blowfish, you know, cracked rear view or whatever that one of theirs was, the big monster one. So yeah, that's just how they work. They had the volume to do it and they wanted to clean out their warehouse. So these seemingly outrageous offers could be made because they'd already put the money out, right? Like they'd already produced them. If they were able to get a couple sales on the back end by leveraging all the incredible volume they had sitting there not being monetized, they went for it. And that's how they survived for a long time, just off the overrun of big albums. And that's why like smaller boutique albums or stuff that was underselling, or I shouldn't say that, stuff that was underprojected, never got produced in those big numbers. So, you know, it was no wonder. Why is it that They Might Be Giants don't appear in any of those until Flood? Because they weren't on a major record label that could mass produce until that time.
Interesting. Okay, so I didn't know that. That makes a lot of sense, clearinghouse stuff. And, you know, it was always weird to me that the pictures that they had on the little card that would come in the mail were like stuff that you were, you were into a little bit.
Right.
You were willing to kind of give them a chance, but it's not something you might have sought out on your own.
Is there an album that you discovered through Columbia or BMG that then resulted in you having a new fandom? It definitely did for me. That's how I discovered Frank Black's solo work.
That's a great question. God, I don't remember. I mean, I bought so many CDs over the years. It's hard for me to remember which ones came from that batch. There was definitely a lot of classic rock that I purchased through them. And I knew at least some of the songs because I was a lifeguard at the local, you know, at that local apartment complex. And so I would sit there and listen to classic rock all day. It was my classic rock education. So I might, you know, purchase the Steve Miller Band's Greatest Hits or Traffic's Greatest Hits or some of that other stuff. There were definitely some things that I didn't know about, like Canned Heat or like Steppenwolf. I will say Supertramp. I loved Supertramp's Greatest Hits, and I got that through one of those record company dealios. And you realize, like, oh man, there's a lot of songs, you know, through this that I didn't realize. I became an Electric Light Orchestra fan separately because I would hear some of their songs on the radio, you know, on the classic rock stations like Mr. Blue Sky and others. And then I started buying up all of their CDs, their album Face the Music, which had some gems on it. So quite a few other albums as well. So, but I don't know. Nothing. I was going to say some of the 10,000 Maniacs stuff, actually, I got through BMG and really started to like them quite a bit at the time when I think it was right after East of Eden came out. Mm-hmm. Then went back and started buying some of that stuff. But it'd be hard for me to remember which ones came in that little plastic cellophane and which ones I bought in those long boxes at the local record shop.
Yeah. On the topic of 10,000 Maniacs, their album In My Tribe is not to be missed. It's outstanding. You know, not only do we took in a lot of new music throughout the course of this 10-year podcast voyage, but we also went out probably at least once a year during the run of the Grizz. You and I got together, and we went and saw live acts. We saw Steely Dan together, more than once during the run of the Grizz. We saw Tears for Fears, for example. Is there one concert experience that you and I undertook together during the run of the Grizz that really sticks out to you as the pinnacle of it?
Well, I think that's hard. I would say Tears for Fears for me, because I just love them growing up was great. I thought that concert was spot on. They played just about everything I wanted to hear. It was great to see those guys. It was a small sort of intimate venue, and you know, having them play, didn't they play Mad World like twice?
They did. They kind of teased the slower, more operatic version of it. And then later it came back in its rocking version.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that for me, and then I enjoyed going to see the Monkees reunion show for, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to see Mike Nesmith and see that. That was a lot of fun together. That was a really small venue, but a lot of fun to see those guys. What about you? What concert stands out to you?
Yeah, I'm glad that we got to see Steely Dan before the passing of Walter Becker. We just kind of made it in under the wire. It was a beautiful day that we were out too. You know, it was great getting there as the sun was going down and Steve Winwood was at the piano. That was really peaceful. Of course, we had our ticket shenanigans where somehow we ended up like in the eighth row when it was all said and done. I love that. But like you, when we went to the Keswick outside of Philadelphia and saw Mike, Mickey, and Peter together as the Monkees, one, the show was just jubilant. It was so ecstatic. Everyone in that room was loving every second of it, including Penn of Penn and Teller. And then after the fact, between us trying to sneak into this bar where we saw Mickey Dolenz was having a drink, trying to meet them on the tour bus, trying to sneak backstage like we're in a Mentos commercial, it was an adventure top to bottom. It was a freezing cold night, but inside the Keswick, it was red hot. I feel like, for me, it was like I waited a lifetime to see that concert, to see Mike Nesmith as one of the Monkees again, playing all of the songs that you would want to hear, playing The Kind of Girl I Could Love and You Just May Be the One and Sunny Girlfriend and Circle Sky and Listen to the Band. I don't know that I could have asked for much more. We've also talked a whole lot about movies over the course of the Grizz, and we've seen the golden age of superhero movies, one of the main topics of this podcast for its entire run. Now superhero culture is ubiquitous. We've covered dozens and dozens of superhero movies, including a whole summer where we did nothing but that, and a different summer where all we did was watch the theatrically released Batman movies. In the run of the Grizz, is there a superhero movie that sticks out head and shoulders above all others to you?
Ooh, that's tough. A couple of different layers to this, because also we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that we now have children, right?
So this is true.
During the run of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, we were childless, and then we suddenly have children. And now in that mix, I've been able to enjoy like a lot of these superhero films through the eyes of my children as well. So although my son has never seen, and my son and daughter have never seen any of the Batman films, just like, you know, some scenes with the Tumbler or something like that, but they've never seen Batman Begins or The Dark Knight or anything like that. I have to say two stand out for me during this run. I had just basically moved to New York City, and you and I was kind of just starting my career at Fox, and you and I were still, you know, maybe it was like a year or year and a half of the Grizz, you know, growing at the time, after we had launched, and the Dark Knight had just come out. Being able to deep dive the Dark Knight and all that that movie meant to superhero films and what it meant to me is one of my favorite movies of all time. That to me probably stands out. I would say the Avengers is a close second for me. What about you?
Yeah. I think the Dark Knight Rises is the one for me. I think it's the best Batman movie ever made. And I know that's an unpopular opinion. People they love The Dark Knight. Or, you know, they latch on to 89 Batman. That's not to say that that's not one of our favorites, but I love The Dark Knight Rises. I reference it frequently when I teach professional wrestling. The way that that story continually heightens and raises the stakes to a fever pitch until all that's really left is for Batman to punch Bane in the face over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Right.
It builds to such a climax. And to borrow a term from professional wrestling, it also has what I think is the best false finish I've ever seen in a movie. So here comes the spoiler. It's a scene that always gets me. And I bet you I've watched it well over 24 times now. Toward the end of the third act, with a neutron bomb strapped to the bat, Batman flies the bomb out of the city, past the bridge where they're trying to get the kids out of Gotham. And one of the kids on the bus, you know, when being warned, like, this is it, it's going down, it's about to happen, sees the bat coming with the bomb. And he's like, it's Batman. That makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up every time. They really earn every bit of that moment. And then, of course, he flies out over the bay, and it looks like Batman bites it. They marketed the movie to get that reaction out of you. And it absolutely worked. And it still works every time I watch that movie back. I love The Dark Knight Rises. Now, there are other movies out there that are, I think there may be more fun, like Civil War with the fight scene on the tarmac in Germany. That's the closest thing to a real life comic book fight we're ever going to see. But I love The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I mean, Dark Knight Rises is right there. Right next to The Dark Knight for me, and I could go back and forth on either of them. To me, it just, if you had to ask in the pantheon of the Grizz, what stood out, it was that just moving to New York City, seeing it, you coming up to New York City, we saw it on the big screen in Manhattan. Remember that?
I do. In fact, one of my very favorite movie going experiences happened when you and I were in that theater. It's the scene where they finally capture the Joker. And Jim Gordon, who you think is dead, pulls his helmet off and he says, "We gotcha." And as soon as the audience saw that it was Gordon, this gigantic ovation broke out. And I remember commenting on the Grizz when we reviewed it. When has Commissioner Gordon ever gotten an ovation in a Batman movie? But the place went bananas for that moment. It was so good.
Oh, it was so great. Yeah, so that whole experience for me, in my favorite movie theater in the country, by the way, is the one in Lincoln Center in Manhattan. And I had a friend of mine recently who just went there to see he went to go see Dunkirk on that screen because it's such a great – I mean the sound system, the screen, the experience in that theater is second to none. A lot of Hollywood premieres will take place at that theater. James Bond, that's where I got to interview Daniel Craig on the red carpet right there at that theater. And they had the Batman premiere there at that theater as well, the New York premiere. So that's a great, great theater. And that experience of seeing The Dark Knight in that theater and then talking about it on the Grizz was great. But I love The Dark Knight Rises. My wife and I often, you know, I think, I don't know, we often, you know, do our little Bane impressions and to me, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's hard to follow in Heath Ledger's footsteps as the Joker, but man, did Tom Hardy pull it off, right?
I mean, thought you were ready to be like that Jared Leto in Suicide Squad, huh? Juggalo Joker? Yeah.
Oh, God. I still haven't seen Suicide Squad, by the way.
You ain't missing out, buddy. One of the other real recurring themes here on The Grizz has been travel. And that's because when the program started, it was really at like the height of when I toured internationally as a professional wrestler. I sometimes was, traveling to other parts of the planet between 6 and 10 times a year. In fact, I think it might have been year one or two of The Grizz is when I went to Japan, which was always like the single biggest goal of my entire professional wrestling career. And then as the years went on, you had the opportunity to travel more as well. You got out there and got to see more of the world. Your photography trip to New Zealand falls within this realm, right? When you went, some of your first times to Europe all fell within this realm. Is there a trip that you undertook during the 10-year run of The Grizz that really sticks out to you as like a life-changing event?
It's a great question. I mean, the life-changing event for me was definitely my New Zealand trip. It was the trip that I sat next to these two real estate investors on the flight. I've told this story, you know, many times in interviews over the years, but I don't know that I've necessarily recounted it here. But yeah, my trip to New Zealand, where my family, we flew out to San Francisco to spend time with my in-laws. And then I, the next day, took the trip to New Zealand for five days to shoot photos with my friend Trey Ratcliffe, one of the great photographers of the world. And I didn't have much time there. You know, when you go to New Zealand, it's a very long flight. So you don't just go for 5 days unless you're there for business or something. You try to spend a couple of weeks, you know, or longer if you can. And much like what you did in Australia, right? How much time did you spend in Australia?
Actually, on the ground, 6.5 days.
So a little bit longer than me, but yeah, you don't want to be there for 2 days. It's too long of a flight to not experience that place. So very similar flight times, you know, New Zealand, Australia. So on that flight, it was like 16 hours from San Francisco. And if you knock off the 5 or 6 hours that I had already flown from the East Coast to San Francisco, you're well over 20 hours to get there. So after a 16-hour flight, I'm kind of groggy, waking up. And these two people are sitting next to me in their mid-50s or so. And they asked me, how long am I going to be in New Zealand? And I said, oh, 5 days and I have to get back. You know, I've got to work. And I said, how long are you going to be in New Zealand? And they said, oh, we're going to be there for 2 months. And I said, what in the world do you do that you can go to New Zealand for 2 months? Because they didn't look retired. You know, they didn't look like they were elderly or something. And he said, oh, I'm a real estate investor. And I said, ah. And then that next 45 minutes upon descent really changed the course of my life, listening to where they invested, how they bought properties, what they went after. And that set the course for me for the rest of my life. I mimicked exactly what they did and started buying properties and doing the exact same thing. And it's led to me being able to build my business, retire from television, and support my family. So I don't know that there's a more impactful trip in my life. That was probably it. But yeah, there's been a lot, you know, my trip to Ireland and then had my honeymoon and went through France and that was an amazing, amazing trip with my wife into mm-hmm. Paris and then down to Bordeaux and spending those days eating oysters and arcachon and drinking great wines in Bordeaux and seeing this medieval town of Saint-Emilion. That's probably one of my favorite. That's probably my favorite trip of all time. I mean, that trip to that region with my wife, I don't think anything comes close to that. But what about you? So Japan is the number one on your list?
Well, I've had a lot of great trips. Granted, they're virtually all business related, so they happen like a whirlwind. Sometimes I come back from them and it's like, was I ever really gone? You know, it goes by in the blink of an eye. Going to Japan was something I wanted for 13 years. To me, that was what made a professional wrestler, that you got the opportunity to go to Japan. And part of that opportunity was arranged for me by a colleague in wrestling, it was sort of like meant to be a gift to me. And I had the opportunity to go, but unfortunately, I was befallen by the most serious concussion of the latter part of my career, about a month and a half, I think it was, before I was meant to go to Japan. What happened was I was wrestling in the Ted Petty Invitational out in the Midwest, came flying out of the ring and went right through the arms of my opponent and flew like a rocket headfirst into a floor and completely knocked myself out and scrambled my brains. I was counseled by all reasonable physicians to not get on a plane and travel. At the time, the flight was, I think, about 14 hours to Japan. However, I had worked so long and hard for this opportunity, and admittedly, our understanding of the severity of concussions was a lot different back then. I went anyway. And the sad reality of that trip, despite the fact that it is the realization of exactly what I wanted for myself in professional wrestling, I remember very little of it. A lot of it is in a fog, and a lot of those couple of months surrounding that concussion are in a fog. I remember the night after I landed on my head that evening, I went back and was taken to a hotel where I had a room to myself, and I just lied on the bed, and the room would not stop spinning. It didn't matter what I did. I could not get the room to stop spinning. And when I came back from Japan, if not for the couple photographs that I'd taken, there are days of that trip I cannot recall. But
I remember.
Really,
I remember you shared some photos. Yeah, you came back. We had lunch, like when you got back, and you were showing me the toilet, the Japanese toilets and all that.
Yes.
Like the seat with the seat warmer and everything. I'm like, wow, I want one of those. Do you recall? I mean, that's fascinating to me because I don't think I knew the severity of that concussion. I mean, and you know, you look at like Bugs Bunny cartoons, right? Not to make light of it, but the sort of stars swirling around the head. That wasn't just a creative license, right? That really is what it must be like.
Yeah, it wasn't in that case. I can't say that of all my concussions, but the one from the Ted Petty Invitational, definitely. I was frightened. That night I was really frightened. I knew that I had a busy weekend of wrestling ahead of me, and I thought, how on earth am I going to get through this?
Just out of curiosity, you talk about that those few months being a bit of a fog for you. Do you – I don't remember exactly when that occurred, but have you gone back and listened or watched any of the content that you produced at the time, like listened to Grizz episodes from that time or watched videos that you produced at that time? Do they seem weird to you?
Yeah, I watched the match that I had the next afternoon, the day after the concussion, not even 24 hours because it was in the evening and the next match was the following afternoon. And I have like an out-of-body experience when I watch it because I have no memory of wrestling that match. And there are a few others. So, for example, when this was, I guess, a more popular thing to do, right? People would make like music videos of their favorite wrestling moves and post them to YouTube. And then maybe you'd get tagged on social media like, hey, I made a new music video of my favorite Mike Quackenbush moves. So I thought, oh, somebody took some time to do this. This is cool. Let's go watch this. There are a couple matches just from that general time frame that I had no memory of. And here's how I knew this. I'm watching these clips and I was like, oh, that's not me. What's that? And I would rewind the video and I'd be like, oh, that is me. When did I have that match? And I have kept up until maybe a year or two ago when I really got lax about it. I used to have a really meticulous record of every match I wrestled, the date, the town, who my opponent was, and the organization. And when I go back and look, like those ones that I have no memory of, they all fall into that window around 2007 after the Ted Petty Invitational. But yeah, it was I often wish I had been more fully present. Of course, circumstances dictated that I was not for that trip to Japan because I worked very, very hard for a very long time to have the opportunity to set foot in a Michinoku Pro ring. And Michinoku Pro, a small Japanese organization in the northeast corner of that country, is in large way or is largely responsible for inspiring Chikara.
Right. When you look at the business, too, if you think about your business over these years that we've done the Grizz, how would you say that that's matured, developed, changed, stretched, deflated? When you look at it, what do you think?
When Chikara first fell entirely into my lap, which was 8 months after we incorporated, and my then business partner, Tom Carter, decided to leave the business. We went through this battle with the Allentown Zoning Board, and it drained the company coffers. Like having to hire the attorneys that represented us and for them to research what the zoning laws were, and we go and have these hearings and blah, 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 blah. On the day that Tom resigned, there were single digits in the bank account, less than $10 in a corporate business account. It seemed really desperate. And he was good at the parts of the business that I was not good at. I've never had much of a mind for like budget. Like I'm always the last guy to be like, oh, right, the money, the licensing, the insurance, you name it. The creative end of things was my thing. And even in the very beginning, I don't think I was a very good teacher. And I certainly was not a good ambassador for my brand. But in the 10 years that the Grizz has been around, I think I've turned into a pretty good teacher. I think I've turned into a pretty good ambassador for my brand. And I've had to learn to get good at other parts of the job. I've had such an education in fields like intellectual property since, we've had the Grizz. Because the reasons that I got into professional wrestling at the very start of this journey, right? If you want to go back and rewind even past Wilson War 94, an oft-mentioned event here in the history of the Grizz. I got into wrestling because I loved colorful characters and I loved that live combat theater. I loved acrobatics. It looked like live superhero fights. All that was very attractive to me. I did not get into professional wrestling to learn about liability insurance, music licensing, the intellectual property that governs characters and trademarks and copyrights and all those kinds of things. But I've had to learn all of that. I've gotten such an education from running my own business. And that education never really stops. It just takes on different forms. And something I've come to appreciate, especially becoming a better storyteller over years, because I've had no choice but to become that, is identifying the through lines in my personal life and in my professional life. And now when I go back and watch older seasons of Chikara, we just finished our 18th season, I can almost eerily see the theme emerge of whatever was going on in my personal life being reflected in the wrestling that I wrote.
That's fascinating.
What about you? Because in terms of giant career changes, your story is an epic one over these last 10 years.
Well, it's been crazy, obviously, as I've moved around the country in the television business, and we started the Grizz just as I was leaving Philadelphia before I made it to the major network. And then we're wrapping up the Grizz just as I retired from the major network and kind of, you know, really going out on my own with my own company and my own investing strategies and all that that holds for the new year. And it's been crazy. I mean, it's been an amazing journey. It's hard to believe. You know, it's hard to believe, too, when kind of gather up during the holidays with the family and, you know, to see where I've come from and where my family has grown and where there's some friction, you know, and some of the memes that maybe still persist in the family over the years. To see my dad, you know, over Christmas, he sat down and he said, he just handed me his phone and he said, can you show me how to, my mom had turned him on to my YouTube channel with all of my, you know, financial education videos and everything else on Morris Invest. And he said, I spent one afternoon, son, watching about 3.5 hours of your videos. He said, I just was taking notes after notes and I couldn't believe it. And how do I subscribe? And, you know, he wanted to know more about how to always have these videos available, basically. And I was showing him how to use the YouTube app and stuff. And I was just so, you know, touched by that. And it's been an incredible journey. I mean, I can remember, you know, just not too long ago, like really struggling to make ends meet and put, you know, and what am I going to do? Should I? And, you know, you get all these flights of fancy over the years. You know, you and I have definitely had so many. We used to joke about the Don LaPree things that we would order in the, you know, infomercial stuff and
Burn Lounge.
Burn. Oh, right. Remember that thing?
Yes, I
did. What was Burn Lounge? That was something I remember when I lived in Orlando. That was even before the Grizz, but it was something. It was like a way to get MP3s, but it was like an affiliate MP instead of using like Napster, right? You would sign up if you wanted to download music. You could go through my Burn Lounge, right, and you could download music through me, and I would get like a small cut of everything you bought and downloaded.
Exactly.
Man, that thing exploded on the launch pad, didn't it?
We were closer to warehousing and shipping the perfect black zip-ups out of your garden shed than we were to making $1 from Burn Lounge, buddy.
Oh, man, what a disaster. But yeah, I mean, over the years, it's going down. So, no, it's been an incredible journey. And, you know, honestly, it's one of the main reasons that, you know, to be focused on what's important in this new year for my company and the family and where I want to take things. I've got to, you know, it's often said, you know, if you can focus on that one thing, it gets you closer to your goals. And I know that when I'm focused on the one thing, i.e. my company, then I grow in tremendous ways. It's when I start to straddle, you know, a fence and try to go one way and try to go another way that inevitably something suffers. You know, trying to, when people say, hey, would you like to be a part of this new program? And I'll get people want to book phone calls with me to do this and to do that. And honestly, if it's not in alignment with my goals anymore, I can't do it. And it's been a big realization for me to be able to say no to things. You know, I'm always willing to take a phone call and like hear people out. Right. But you know, hey, no, I can't do it this quarter. I can't do it these next two quarters. Maybe it's something we can explore in September. And that's been a really big lesson for me. Usually I would try to cram everything into January or February, and then inevitably everything would suffer and you can't have success that way. So, That's been a really big level of maturity, level of growth that I didn't have 10 years ago, for sure.
Yeah. You know, not only have Clayton and I made tons of podcast content throughout this journey, we teamed up together on shows like Daddy on Board and The Trending Show. We've also done separate projects. Clayton had his Empowering podcast. His current real estate podcast does bonker numbers and comes out multiple times a week. Separate from Clayton, I was involved and still am with Deep Blue Something, a Chikara podcast, for example. But we're also more diverse in terms of the content that we create. We have both published more than one book during the run of The Grizz, from stuff like gluten-free diets up to how to leverage a HELOC to pay off your investment. Is there something like that outside the podcast sphere that you have produced and put out there that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I would say definitely the work that my wife and I did on the How to Pay Off Your Mortgage in 5 Years book has been the most in alignment with my brand and has been consistent with what I'm hoping to achieve, right? It's in alignment with real estate, wealth building, financial IQ, financial education, helping people build wealth and helping people improve their lives. You know, it's funny when I look at the shiny object syndrome stuff of like doing like a book on, a gluten-free diet, you know, it's like, it's funny to think that, you know, I put something like that out there, but hey, you know, you live and learn, right? It certainly taught me a little bit about the Amazon publishing platform, if nothing else, right? And I've certainly since pulled it down because there are many better resources out there instead of just like a money-making scheme for me to publish a book. But I would say definitely that piece of content. And honestly, launching the Investing in Real Estate podcast, I hear from so many people. I've just been blessed with like even a number of text messages over the past 24 hours from people here at the new year thanking me for the content that we've produced that has helped change their life to purchasing their first rental properties and building wealth. That's been incredibly meaningful to me. So yeah, I would say the book, but definitely the podcast has been a game changer for me. What about you? You've published like 13 books since this podcast has started.
Well, I wish I had more time to write. I feel like the rate at which I produce that content has slowed so much in the last 10 years. Of course, most of that is because the writing I do is no longer for public consumption. And I'm very proud of my most recent book, 7 Keys to Becoming a Better Performer. That's top of mind for me because my first Amazon royalty just hit this morning. And it did make me, when looking at the report, ask this question: 45 people in Japan bought this book? Because it's in English. Nevertheless, a couple things that I think I'm very proud of. Number one, a song I wrote called From the Ashes was recorded by Stan Bush. And Stan, I've worked with Stan now for several years as a result of him being on The Grizz. I've worked behind the scenes with Stan Bush on his last 3 or 4 albums, mostly in a marketing and consulting role. And it's been a really interesting adventure. Working with Stan, it's not always been smooth sailing, so to speak. Although this is not the kind of thing I normally talk about, Stan and I often butt heads about the direction of what he's doing musically. I've begged him for what feels like close to 10 years now to take his music in a different direction, and he stays on a very particular brand year after year after year. Now, granted, there's nobody that does motivational rock like Stan Bush does, which is why he was the only guy that could possibly record From the Ashes, which is as much a personal anthem for me as it was perfectly suited to where it appears in the movie The Ashes of Chikara. But something that I wrote being recorded by a guy I grew up as a fan of since childhood was really something magical. And the song's not bad, if I do say so myself. But in terms of singular content, I think for obvious reasons, it is the speech I gave at Ignite Philly 16 about the art of professional wrestling. And it went viral for a little while. I don't know if a week ever goes by that somebody doesn't bring it up to me. And I also think when I die, that is the video of me most likely to be embedded in my online obituary. I remain really proud of that. And it's still out there in the ether. You could go and watch it right now. It's only 5 minutes long, and I'm still proud of it.
That's good. Well, as we wrap things up here on this final episode of The Grizz, I think we should take the last 5 minutes or so and just talk about some of the interviews that we've had here on the show that stand out. And this, you know, the benefit of doing this show is that you and I just got to pick and choose who we wanted to talk to. There was no producer telling us what to do. And therefore, there were people from our childhood. There were people contemporaneously that we wanted to talk to. And we've had quite a slew of guests here on the show over the years. And I never thought, I mean, even, you know, I run in some pretty big celebrity circles when I was working in television, and even beyond television, I've interviewed some pretty darn big stars over the years. But I have to say, some of the ones we've had here on The Grizz, I've been more impressed by, more touched to have interviewed than anybody I've done and interviewed on television. What about you?
Yeah. To get ready for this, I went back and listened to every interview episode that we did. And listening to some of them back made me realize, you know, you can kind of tell when you hear us, we weren't so hot talking to Michael Uslan. Executive producer of all things Batman, it felt like he showed up with an agenda sometimes. We had him on more than once. That's not one of our better ones. But three that stood out to me, the first one I want to mention is the one with Thomas Dolby. And the Thomas Dolby interview is really, it's all over the place. It covers all kinds of topics. It is not just about his career. And I think that's part of why he was so willing to talk about things like technology, his personal relationship with J.J. Abrams, viral marketing and alternate reality gaming that surrounded his album, The Map of the Floating City, which he was out kind of promoting at the time. And you and I got advanced copies of the album, I think about 3 weeks before we had him on. And you and I had a very similar feeling going into this interview. What if we hate this album and the reason he's coming on is to talk about it? How are we going to dance around the fact that we've never sugarcoated anything here on The Grizz? Like, we've never avoided being critical of anybody, even our favorite musical artists. When Sting did the Loot album, as much as we love Sting, we were the first ones to take a dump on him.
Right.
When The Ocean came out by Nez, I couldn't wait to tell everybody how much I hated this new album by my very favorite musical artist. But luckily, we loved Map of the Floating City. And I think our Thomas Dolby interview is one of our best.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. I also think that we had a great interview with John Flansburgh from They Might Be Giants.
That's the next one on my list.
That was just a ton of fun. I mean, here, you know, growing up listening to They Might Be Giants, and here John Flansburgh just didn't want to get off the phone with us or off Skype. He just wanted to hang out with us, and we just kept going. We're like, "Do you have to go?" He's like, mm-hmm. "Oh no, I can hang out." And I just imagine sort of him being in his home studio, just kind of hanging out, talking and geeking out with us about music and you know, other stuff that we had a chance to. Does that interview hold up? You just recently listened to it.
It sure does. The Thomas Dolby interviews in episode 170. The John Flansburgh one is in 150. Grizz 150. Hard to imagine, almost 300 episodes ago. But I do remember how long ago it was because of the day on which we interviewed John Flansburgh. On that day, I had to pick my son up from daycare. And there was a specific cutoff time at this daycare center. So if that, let's say it was 5 p.m., for every minute you were late as a parent picking up your child, they penalized you $1. So if you're 5 minutes late, you pay them $5. 10 minutes late, you pay them $10. Never before and never after this day was I ever penalized, except on the day John Flansburgh stayed on the line with us. And because we ran well past the agreed upon time with him, but he just stayed on, I thought, there's no way I'm jumping off this call. Like, we will never have one of They Might Be Giants on the podcast ever again. And by the time I got to pick my son up, I was out $40.
Well worth it. Well worth that $40. I would also say, and why his name's escaping me at the moment, Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Glenn Phillips.
Yeah, Glenn Phillips. That was perhaps my favorite interview. I thought
he was. Yeah, you really did love that one. And that one you took the reins on, I think, because you know so much more about Toad than I do. But I thought you really got to flex your muscles as an interviewer in that one.
He was very open. I was pleasantly surprised that I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Love Actually, but the old rock and roller who goes on the radio station to promote his horrible Christmas song, you know, and he's like, ask me anything. And the guy's like shocked that he's allowing him to be asked anything. You know, he's like, all right, what's the best shag you ever had? He's like, Britney Spears. It's like, really? He's like, nah, she was crap. But he was wildly open about the music business, having to re-record Toad the Wet Sprocket songs, in order to basically make money off of them, right? It was really interesting. And then, of course, getting the band back together again for a new album and tour. Plus, he had some solo work that we talked about, and it was a lot of fun. And he was gracious. Plus, he was very funny too. So I thought he had a good wry sense of humor, and he fit right in with us. Could have been a third co-host the day that we did that show. So I really enjoyed that. And then I have to say also, just as a geek, and I can't believe we had Mike Nelson from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000, the two captains of the Satellite of Love on the show. That just is amazing to me. And that tickles my geek bone. I wish we could have had people like, you know, Brian Regan on the show and, Jake Johansson and people like that. We tried. Yeah. We certainly reached out to different folks. Is there one regret?
I reached out to Jake Johansson multiple times through his website and never got so much as a response. And Jake Johansson, you're not that busy, buddy. Like, right. Your schedule's on your website. You are not that busy. There's one other interview I want to mention very quickly. Interesting that they're all spaced exactly 20 episodes apart. 150 is John Flansburgh, 170 is Thomas Dolby, and 190 is Jane Monheit. And what I loved was that Jane Monheit was one of those, you did not get the sense that she was there to promote her album. She was on to just have a conversation with us. The first 5 minutes she's on, all we talk about is 60s Batman.
Right.
She's marvelous. So not only is she – there's just a mega talented jazz singer that I think doesn't get anywhere near the attention she deserves. She came on and could not have been more charming. And suffice to say, while she's on with us, you and I were certainly charmed by her. The Jane Monheit interview back in episode 190 I think is terrific. It does seem like especially around the holidays each year, I tried to make some effort to see, could we find somebody in Sting's ensemble so that I could get Sting on the podcast kind of as a gift for you? And every year I failed miserably at it. At least four times I, and at least twice you, attempted to reach out to Mike Nesmith's people, and we just got nowhere with it. Like, not so much as a response.
Yeah. That was brutal.
Right. Like,
I would have loved. Yeah, those are my two big regrets. I mean, I would have loved to have had Sting on the show. That would have been just the ultimate. And I would have loved to be able to speak to Mike Nesmith or just to sit back and listen to you interview Mike Nesmith would have been a real treat to hear that. So those are my two big interview regrets that we were never able to get here on the show. I've never been able to interview them on Fox or anything or any, you know. But hey, you never know. But, well, my friend, we are at the hour mark on the final episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Any parting thoughts, words of wisdom before we let everyone go?
Well, our lives have undergone dramatic change in the last 10 years, and most of it you'll hear documented in the last 430 plus episodes of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. From marriages and divorces, from going from being childless to childful, massive changes in the direction of careers and companies, experiments come and gone, tastes have changed, opinions have evolved. But this is a remarkable document, really, of our friendship and what it's like when you and I just get together and talk about music, movies, what's going on in the world, the concert tour upcoming that we want to go and see, and how our jobs and the world around them are changing all the time. And there have been weird appendices to this podcast too, probably most notably being Daddy on board, but the trending show as well, where we've got to branch out a little bit. And yet the thing I think which has always kept everyone coming back here to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe over the years, all the loyal people that we've had when we were at our commercial zenith or wherever the heck we are now, God knows I don't look at the numbers. It's the fact that people have always understood that beneath this all, you and I have a camaraderie that is very sincere and genuine and very loving that goes back more than 30 years. And I think it's been our shared history and the ability to share in it with us here on The Grizz that has always kept the Eggheads coming back.
Well said, my friend. And, you know, that's the thing. Our friendship will continue beyond this show and beyond what we do here.
So you think.
Right. This, by the way, this is the end of our friendship.
Canceled. Is,
yeah, we've just been canceled, so that's the end of our friendship. It's like the Partridge Family.
Look, make me a wish, ain't going to pay me to talk to you.
So we will continue, of course, to we will continue to have our great friendship over the years, and that will continue to grow and blossom. And I want to just thank all of the fans of the Egghead Army that have been with us for many, many years. We've had fans here who date back like 10 years listening to this show. So some have come and gone. New ones have added, old ones have left, but hey, there's been through lines of some fans have been here for many, many years. So much love to you all, and much love to you, my best friend. This has been a great journey over these 10 years. And
well, you know what? On the topic of thanks, a few other thank yous perhaps are in order. To our long-suffering sound engineer wizard, Jim Metzendorf, who somehow always makes this podcast sound good, and sometimes must relentlessly drop in the dated musical choices that Clayton and I make here for you. I also want to personally thank Cobra Electronics, one of our long-standing sponsors who, for the better part of 5 years, kept this podcast going, as well as the trending show during my tenure as the host. And if you are a fan of Chikara in any way, shape, or form, without saying too much, something I hope that you will appreciate is there are years where Chikara would not have existed if not for Cobra Electronics. The sponsorship that they gave to Clayton and to I supported so many other projects we were involved in that it would not have been possible without those guys being so generous to us for so many years. And we had tons of great sponsors. Bake Me a Wish, Duracell, Yoohoo, the list goes on and on and on. But I wanted to just take a moment and offer my thanks one more time to Cobra Electronics, because there were years where they and they alone kept the ship afloat. And of course, my thanks to you, my crazy best friend, real estate maven, who, no matter how crazy the travel, the demands, the work became, always managed to carve out time every week for us to sit around and talk about music from the 80s, dudes in spandex, and all the other types of stuff that we love.
Indeed. Well, much love to you, my friend. And this has been, it's been a blast born out of that coffee shop when you and I came up with the idea to wrapping it up here on my birthday, basically on New Year's Eve. And as this is publishing at the turn of the year. So I'm looking forward to a great 2018. I can't wait to see what's in store for you and everything you have coming up. And likewise for me on my business side and everything there as well. So my friend, that's going to do it. Another Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe is in the can, my friend.
Mm-hmm. Adios, amigos.